support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
I'm Ben Weekly. I'm the Director of Development for the International Storytelling Center in Jonesboro, Tennessee.
I love it. So tell me, you can make up a good story? Have you done that? You tried that?
So I am in my position as director of development. I work with our donors. I work with corporate sponsors. I work with foundations who are our grant makers. And I do media and kind of community outreach. So I'm not the master storyteller. I can spin a yarn every now and then when necessary, I suppose.
Have you honed your skills and presentations from attending events at the Storytelling Center?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's interesting how embedded storytelling is in the fabric of this community and this area, whole region. Yeah. So I go to my kid's soccer game, and Hannah Harvey, who's a very well-renowned storyteller and academic, a scholar and practitioner in the area. She lives on a farm and on the border of Virginia and Tennessee. Hannah Harvey's kid is on my kid's soccer team, and we strike up a conversation, you know, just so that those little relationships, those tellers like Barbara McBride Smith lives here in Jonesboro. You bump into her from time to time. You know, Jimmy Neal Smith still lives here, and you'll see him at Main Street Cafe or down at the Corner Cup.
Living, breathing, immersed in the culture.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I come at this as a development professional out of the military, but also as kind of an amateur artist, if you will. So I got involved in some veterans organizations that use arts, particularly writing, poetry, narrative arts, to do healing work, right?
With tell PTSD stories. People?
Essentially, yeah, but trauma in general.
Yeah.
And so that lends itself, that background. I still facilitate a workshop once a month for an organization called Community Building Artworks, you know, just because I love the work. And so that lends itself pretty well, I think, to a good understanding of what applied storytelling does. But it's been really nice to be in the presence of some of the masters. I mean, I got to hang out with Sheila Arnold for a few hours the other week when she was in town recording. I meet Donald Davis. I see Bill Lepp every, couple months when he's in recording. So
humbling probably in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So your world has been upside down for the last couple of years. You did your annual festival, but it was virtual again this year, correct?
Correct.
So how did that go?
So it went well. Of course, there's some disappointment. We have received some feedback. Some people really loved the convenience of being able to watch it at home. Some of our audience is older, and, the festival environment is getting less and less accessible
physically
for people, who have... who are advanced in age. And so some of them are able to access the festival when maybe they wouldn't have come this year if it were in person. In general, everybody wants it to be in person, loves that.
Part of the magic.
In person. Yeah, it's, as I mentioned earlier, storytelling, the art form, isn't just the story or the teller. It's an interaction between the storyteller, the story, and the audience. And the audience plays a part in forming how the storyteller is going to approach the tale and how they're going to tell it, what parts they're going to emphasize, what images they're going to bring forward. And the audience providing that feedback in their body language, in their laughter, applause, in their stunned silence, that really cues the teller in going forward with the story. It's been interesting. There's been tellers, we've taped live with a small audience here some of the festival content, and it was nice because the teller, some of the tellers are in front of, a small crowd, and we're talking 25 or 30 people. It's the first time they've been not virtual in 18 months or so.
Wow.
And, we've had them say, gosh, I've been doing this for 20 years, and I'm really nervous. I was really nervous going out there. And you're like, why? You do this all the time. It's like, nah, normally I'm not, but it's been a couple of years.
That's really interesting.
You know, everybody wants it in person, but we've had really good positive response. We've got viewers from 49 states. We're missing Wyoming this year, so if you have any listener.
What happened to Wyoming?
I don't know. We had Wyoming last year.
Wow.
But we have listeners from, our viewers from Belgium, the Netherlands, Australia, several countries internationally. You know, in our week-to-week online programming and our well-regarded program, Freedom Stories, this year, we had an even bigger international reach and really reached a very sizable audience, you know, in comparison to what we normally get in the festival, which is already pretty large in-person audience.
But what you're saying is you have different events and functions that go on throughout the year.
Absolutely. Yeah, so the festival is our kind of the crown jewel in the International Storytelling Center's portfolio, where it all kind of comes together. But we have a teller-in-residence program. So we bring a different artist in every week for 26 weeks. Normally runs from May through the fall, ends probably a week or two after festival.
Is that still virtual?
So that was virtual this year. That was virtual last year. And what we've done, we've kind of changed it up a little bit. So it wasn't a 26-week straight through. We did some smaller, like, 8-week segments and moved them around. So, you know, there was some content out there in the winter or early spring, where which are usually kind of off periods for us. But we expect, going into next year, now that we've had, you know, some small, safe, you know, masked and vaccine, you know, we knew they were vaccinated. And so we're really hopeful that moving forward, by the time we get to May next year, we've got the conditions right to have tellers back in the house and seats full. And if, you know, the pandemic spikes again, you know, hopefully we'll be able to find a way to do it in a way that's safe. We may have to limit seating or continue with masks and you know, check people, you know, make sure they're vaccinated, or our allies at the Northeast Regional Health Office recommend.
So this is a nonprofit.
It is.
Undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where your expertise comes in, right?
Correct.
Your outreach to the world and the greater community to generate underwriters and
certainly. And so, you know, we have a very loyal following of people who are not just patrons, but also volunteers and donors. I like to say, I mean, I think a lot of people think of development equals fundraising, fundraising equals asking for money. It's bigger than that. You know, I'm here to develop the capacity of the organization through people's time, their talent, and their treasure. And so whichever one of those or combination somebody's capable of giving, that's all, you know, equally received and equally respected. We depend on our volunteers to run the center day-to-day.
Yeah, you couldn't function overhead.
Absolutely.
Kill you,
And the volunteer list swells for an in-person festival. Hundreds and hundreds of volunteers, many of whom have been doing this for decades.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know, volunteers, our advocates out there who keep in touch with the storytelling community and promote us. A lot of most people in our orbit would say that they were brought into the festival or an event through word of mouth. So that's huge. And then fundraising. So I connect people who want to do more to support the mission to the best means to do it.
Your time is critical and you want to be surgical about your missions. It would seem to me that going to corporate within the region, within Tennessee, would be a brilliant way to go.
So we've gotten phenomenal support from foundations, both local, regional, and national. And we've really done well with grant writing and grant proposals. We've expanded our corporate relations and corporate sponsorships recently in the last several years. And we've got relationships in the area with, you know, some of the most important institutions. You know, Ballad Health is a recurring sponsor, and we absolutely could not do what we do without the region's, you know, main healthcare entity supporting us.
You do endowments?
At this time, we do not have an endowment. We're in discussion. So we have just recently unveiled a legacy society. So the Storytelling Legacy Society was rolled out during the festival. You know, many of our supporters, without ever being asked, have put us in a bequest. And I've found that just in meeting with people who are year-to-year donors. So one of the first things I said, it's not the normal way you'd approach a fundraising program, building that out. That'd be sort of the pinnacle. But I said, gosh, we've got enough people that have already enjoyed us for so long and want their legacy to be storytelling and mm-hmm. the festival and the other work we do throughout the year. I've got to figure out a way soon to recognize those people and let them know how much we appreciate them and also help encourage more folks to do that. A lot of people think that, you know, philanthropy and giving is only for the wealthy, and they can only, you know, do what they do year to year. I think, you know, there are ways for people to make a lifetime impact that are accessible to most Americans. You know, it's just a matter of finding the cause that they want to support, and we're lucky in our case to have several of those folks.
Yeah.
But all that to say, you know, down the line, we'd love to have an endowment that would support us kind of year to year.
Yeah.
So, and let our supporters know that, you know, hey, we're going to be here for another 50 years.
Very possible.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. From the outside world now in this reality, mm-hmm. if somebody wants to dial in and tune in the world of storytelling through here, what's your online world? What presence do you have?
So you can follow us on all the social media channels, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
We have YouTube series.
We are present on YouTube. We have a YouTube channel. You can go back and watch just about all the material from festivals in 2016 up to 2019. Mm-hmm. We have material that shows some of our other impact and our other work outside of the festival and Teller in Residence. So we do a program called Shiro's Journey as part of our educational outreach. There's some wonderful videos on that showing the impact of bringing in young girls from vulnerable populations in the area and empowering them with storytelling, you know, a workshop from, you know, professional artists, helping them develop their own story to overcome and succeed. Young Appalachian Story Summit is another one we've been doing for a few years. You can check that out. Empowering, you know, community leaders, young people to become community leaders with the skill of storytelling.
And how about immersion in the elementary schools of doing some storytelling?
Yeah, absolutely. 1A. So our writ large, right now, our outreach and education program falls under the banner we call Stories for Change. And so various programs have been going to schools. At one time, we called it Kids Institute. And then another program called I Have a Story most recently works. There's a great YouTube video you can watch on that. But, you know, we went to a local schools and worked with the students to develop stories about the unseen people around the school. You know, the secretary, the janitors, you know, those people that make the school work but mm-hmm. aren't teachers and principal. And so helping them develop those stories that show all people in a positive light and show, you know, how they all contribute to the school.
And observing from the inside, I'm sure you see these epiphanous, transformative moments amongst the kids.
Oh, absolutely.
Through what they do.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a really powerful example on YouTube, but, you know, I won't give it away, you know, I won't spoil it. But a young girl with a kind of a traumatic family story developing sort of a fictional, mythological kind of approach to what that means and working that out in narrative. And it's just fascinating to see. It's wonderful.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So anything you want to add?
The biggest thing I think folks can know is that we are so much more than a festival and an entertainment medium. So everyone has a story, and everyone is a storyteller. And as we move into the 50th year of the American Storytelling Revival, we see a role for storytelling in this cultural moment in America and the world in centering marginalized voices to tell those stories that haven't been told or that haven't been heard, that need to be heard. and to build community, build peace, to rehumanize the other in this moment where, you know, the world seems so divisive and everybody is separated into an either you're with me or against me camp.
Us and them.
Us and them. Yeah. You know, you'd be amazed looking at the festival, seeing somebody who is clearly probably votes blue, let's just say, next to somebody in a red ball cap. And at that moment, they aren't Republicans or Democrats. They aren't anything but human beings. Mm-hmm. Immersed in the same experience,
a common experience
with the teller on stage and with each other.
I love it. So the best hope for the salvation of Western civilization is right here, the International Storytelling Center.
Home of the world's oldest and most accessible art form.
I love it. Okay, if somebody wanted to learn more about your world, where would you direct us?
Storytellingcenter.net. You can find out more about the festival, more about different storytellers, more about our other programming, and find out about how to link with us on social media. You can sign up for our newsletter, and you'll get more information about different events month to month. And, you know, tap into what's going on in the storytelling community writ large. And my name is Ben Weekly, and I'm the Director of Development for the International Storytelling Center.
Awesome, Ben. Thanks for sharing. And I'm Tom Wilmer, having the pure honor to be at the headquarters of the International Storytelling Center. We'll see you here.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Jonesboro, Tennessee. Come along and join me as I visit with Kiran Singh Sarah, president of the International Storytelling Center. I love that, being a storyteller myself.
It's a crazy idea. When I first discovered there was actually a place that was called an international center dedicated to storytelling, I had the same reaction. But here I am, and now I run the institution.
Going back in your life and your journey, at one time, not too many years ago, you spent time in Northern Ireland, specifically dealing in conflict resolution and using storytelling as a vehicle. Tell us that story.
Well, I went back to Northern Ireland many times. My first time, my first ever girlfriend was from Dromore, County Down. That was my first window to culturism within Northern Ireland. And that was during the time of the Troubles. We were young, 18-year-old, fell in love. And then I remember the time when there was fireworks going out outside our house. This is in England. And then she suddenly crawled up beside me, scared. And I said, I was trying to figure out why she was scared. And she grew up in a time where fireworks were banned because there was constantly bombs going on. And her house was firebombed. And so as I became older, I started to run peace and reconciliation programs using a storytelling approach and working in places like Derry in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, in Larne.
Give me some tangible example of how you use storytelling. That's so fascinating. Yeah.
So a project that I did wasn't actually in Northern Ireland, but it was with Northern Ireland stakeholders.
Right.
So what I did, I got some funding, and we invited to Glasgow, which is like cousin to Belfast, just across the water, and in a museum space, which I ran a museum of religion there, and we brought together, with funding from the Scottish government, we brought in ex-paramilitary members that were once in the IRA, we brought in paramilitary members that were in the UDA, the UVF, the UFF, including police officials, members of the clergy, Roman Catholic Church, the Church of Ireland, Protestant and Catholic, and laymen, people involved.
How did you get them all to come together?
It was part of a process. It was part of a collaborative effort. Northern Ireland had just gone through this 30-year war, and this was the really important... It's almost like to say, okay, we're not at war anymore, physically, but it doesn't mean the tensions go away. That's the liminal space, the space between, where it's really important to kind of like, now let's talk about it. Let's figure out discussions. I remember when we had all these people in a room, and there was obviously the representations of ex-paramilitary, police, officials, and all different types of people.
Total number of people.
In that particular day, there might have been about 20. But remember, I did this for 10 years, so every day we did projects. So this is just one particular
An example of.
And I remember having a group of people, we facilitated a conversation, and we unpacked the experiences, the everyday moments of what it was like to live during a time in experiences of the Troubles, when people might reveal the people that they had lost, or what it meant to be from a place and how other people perceive you as well, or your religion, or your identity, or your place, your neighborhood, as well as Northern Ireland as a whole. But I remember one individual that particular day, he was a member of the Orange Order. The Orange Order is a Protestant fraternity where they, you know, many believe in the Orange Order that the Pope's the Antichrist. I mean, it's a kind of an important... But we had members of the clergy, and he said that particular day, and I remember it, he said, to participate in this one day, right now, my community are going to disown me when I go back home. My faith, my religion, my people, my family members are disowning me, but I believe my religion tells me that I must love my neighbor, and therefore I'm here with you all as my brothers and sisters. Now, the Orange Order is given a bad name. That's why it's so important when we think about these challenges of individuals and what they may be going through, whether you're Palestinian or Israeli, almost like vulnerable to joining a supremacist group. What the importance of storytelling is, it unpacks the story behind the story. I was in Charleston, South Carolina, 6 months after the massacre that took place at the Mother Emanuel Church that took 9 people's lives. The city of Charleston invited me and the International Storytelling to participate and to lead a healing program to understand, to unpack what does violence mean, and to bring communities together and to facilitate that conversation. Now, I remember, like, when I first came to this country, someone said to me, as a person of color with a British accent, it's going to open doors for you in this country that many Americans don't get those doors open. Think about that as a responsibility. Help this country speak to itself. And I remember sitting around a round table, closed door meeting. They had city leadership, they had activists, educators. I said, what could we do? It was a 6 month after the Charleston massacre. And what was going on? There was the whole issue of the Confederate flag, right? Because what could we be doing? I said, well, do what I think what one could be doing right now is do what Northern Ireland did during the height of the Troubles. What they did is they went out and collected stories, objects. They collected a steering wheel that had a bullet hole put for it, and they put it into the museum's collection. They collected toilet tissue written by Bobby Sands, the IRA hunger striker, that was sneaked out of a prison in a condom and up somebody's anus. That's the story of how he got out of the museum. They collected these objects and they waited to the moment until post-conflict where they could actually, where it was safe to invite those communities that had been historically at war with one another to curate the museum exhibit. You go to Derry, Northern Ireland now, you go to the Troubles exhibit, Tower Museum, you'll see a display that is curated with individual stories and moments that reflect this history, but it's curated. What did that exhibition do? It brought a group of people together to unpack this in a shared moment. That's what I think we could be doing in this country. Collect those flags, collect those stories. Maybe in 15 years from now, or hopefully sooner, let's invite those communities. What was this moment like in your life? And what do we have to teach our next generation?
Well, see, that's an interesting diversion in a sense from what the central core of what people assume and think that storytelling is, and that it isn't limited to the oral tradition.
It isn't limited to the oral tradition whatsoever. It's the unfolding of the universe. It's the unfolding of our day. It's the way you decorate your front porch. It's the way that we might walk distinctively in the United States, to the way the foods that we eat. You know, it's... In folklore, you might say, it's telling the story of who we are, where we come from. But we have multiple ways we do that, through our rituals, through our traditions, through our ways to do it subtly. When somebody leaves me a freshly grown okra and leaves it on my front porch, you know, there are these places and spaces that it's not just about... I could tell you a single story right in this moment. It can make you laugh, it can make you cry. But storytelling is about narrative. It's when us as animals were roamed the planet until story binded us into a human species. It's what happens when we call the United States of America just land and people on it. But really, it's the story that binds us as one nation. So story is so powerful. It can be used as a force for good and a force for evil. It can shift minds and it can start wars, but it can also prevent them. And, you know, you think about this from a perspective of the power it has to create revolutions. You know, what did Gandhi do? What did Dr. King do? Dr. King stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963 or 64, and he told his dream, but he was using the power of storytelling to relate to people's emotions and people's feelings and things that they already understood and knew, and he could help to shift the movement forward. Gandhi did the same thing, but he did it through walking a salt march. He was creating this sort of statement.
So that was his metaphorical storytelling.
Exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. So you're the president of the International Storytelling Center in Jonesboro, Tennessee.
Which produces the National Storytelling Festival.
Right.
It's the nation's oldest storytelling festival, and the world's actually. So in 1973, it's what's known as the event that ignited America's storytelling revival, which is now fostered a professional industry of a storytelling industry recognized from the highest levels of the National Endowment for the Arts to Uber, that advertised for, we need a professional storyteller, Google. So there's actually a bigger impact that was created from 1973 that fostered and helped to bring into the everyday experience what we were already doing, but giving it, saying that this is an art form. Each and every one of us are artists. When we craft our stories and we tell them in a certain way, we can make a difference in the world.
Going back in time to the days of tribes and the days of no telecommunication, whatnot, the storyteller was the news deliverer.
Absolutely.
From village to village.
That is absolutely true. Like in my family, not even going back that long ago, who passed on our traditions? I come from a family of refugees and immigrants.
They came from India?
They came from India to East Africa as labor migrants,
uh-huh.
And then from East Africa to Britain as refugees,
uh-huh.
And they were forced to leave. It was related to ethnic,
yeah.
An ethnic persecution. But the point being from all of that, it was like, I remember growing up, all these family gatherings, you know, hundreds of us, all us kids were running around the house while the adults sang songs and told stories through the night. And then at some point during that, not through the night, but earlier on, my grandmother would sit on the chair, or she would sit when we would sit outside under the tree, and we'd always like sit slightly below her out of respect. And what she did is she told stories. She told stories about our heritage, family members, times of independence, the freedom struggle, as well as stories of faith and tradition. And she was passing on wisdom in all of that, that was reminding us, telling us, sharing with us where we come from, who are we, and how can you navigate yourself through this world. You know, how can you take from this identity and realize that you can navigate through a space?
Let's jump to today,
uh-huh.
In Western culture, in America, in Tennessee, using storytelling to bridge cultural divide. How do you do that?
Well, we do what we can. I mean, it's a big job. I like to think that when 11,000 people or 10,000 people come to an event over 3 days, they listen and they engage in an experience. And what happens is you have people in that space that are wearing an NRA cap next to someone wearing a Bernie t-shirt. And that will always be the philosophy that I would always create in a festival. And I think everyone that comes to this festival knows is that this is always going to be an inclusive space.
It's a neutral ground.
I wouldn't say it's neutral. It's a safe space.
Mm-hmm.
It could never really be entirely neutral.
Sure.
But we try to foster a safe space to listen to the stories that provoke us to understand who we are, where we come from as a nation. Like when we bring storytellers from the Gullah traditions or the African-American traditions, from the European-American traditions, and that are thinking about our key events in our history, from the Civil War to Gettysburg Address to 9/11, then what we are doing is like we're shaping these. It's part of who we are. These are the moments that make up our collective story. And these stories are expressions of that. So when we share this moment over 3 days, we get into a natural rhythm. And that fostering of that event, these are master storytellers. We are creating a collective of a spirit that's about, as Catherine Tucker Windham would said from Elba Samuel, Alabama, she said, what storytelling does, it teaches us to listen. There's nothing we can do more right now than learning to listen to one another.
There doesn't have to be a limitation in the thematic thread of their socio-political context.
You can have a tale that's 800 years old told to a story that's like about Piper Kerman, Orange is the New Black, came to the festival and told about 1 year in incarceration, her experiences. Mark Smith, the founder of slam poetry, came from Chicago, and he told stories about the finding of that movement and what slam poetry meant, and this art form that young people are calling it poetry, but really it's personal narrative. Spoken word slam is personal narrative. So, I mean, this is the festival, but there are specific events and spaces that we create when we are trying to encourage dialogue. So Charleston was one example. Another example might be, you know, we send storytellers out into juvenile justice centers. We work with young people who are most at risk in our communities, people that are vulnerable to like opioid epidemic and other types of addictions and gun violence. We try to bring people together to think about what is the narrative being placed on you and how can you reshape the narrative for yourself. You might be poor, you might be from Appalachia, you might be, the world might think of you in a certain way, but when you learn to harness the story of you for yourself and rewire it, you can be the next Dolly Parton. And that's what Dolly Parton did, right? She rewired her story. She didn't turn her back on her community, she just framed it in a different way, and she told her story, and she excelled, and she gave back to her community. The perfect hero's journey.
You know what? Only because it's getting late. I think we're going to have to do a reprise visit with you.
I look forward to it.
But in the meantime, if somebody wanted to learn more about the International Storytelling Center,
you can just come and visit. Give me a call. Come and visit the center. Come and engage in an experience. Jonesboro, the first long weekend, every October. But we have programs throughout the year, tele-residence programs, different storytellers. And that's just one way of doing it. Yeah, just come and visit.
All right. Well, I want to come back.
Yeah. Look forward to you welcoming you back.
Kiran Singh Sirah, president of the International Storytelling Center in Jonesboro, Tennessee. Thank you so much for visiting.
Thank you so much for the interview.
It's my pleasure. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Tennessee. We'll see you here.
Support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives. And Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.